A year ago, I set out to create a podcast celebrating some of the people I've worked with and who are thinking differently about managing land for people and for nature. I'm Pete Leeson, and welcome to Series 3 of Tree Amble Podcast.
This is a podcast about people and farming and trees and nature and how we could all do much better.
Danny and I have become firm friends over the years by working together with Water and Woods. Today, we come together for a walk up a small Lake District stream on a property where we have also planted trees, coppiced hazel, laid hedges, and where the land is being grazed regeneratively. Danny and I chat about fish, water and trees, and much, much more.
Today, I've got the pleasure of meeting Danny Teasdale, or as I call him, Young Danny.
I've been called worse. I'll take that, Pete. Thank you.
And we are, first of all, we're going in search of salmon. And I'm reliably informed by Danny that just over this dry stone wall, we'll find some in a wee beck. So, if I go first...
You go first. I want you to see them.
And if I hear a splash, or if you hear a splash, I've fallen in. But let's just go and have a quick look.
You go in that direction. Okay. I'm going to let you go ahead, Pete.
So Danny's just sent me off to look in a beck that is probably only 4 metres across and just a few inches deep. But
so here's a red, Pete. So they've spawned in there.
Okay.
You see the clean gravel.
Yep.
Indent in the gravel, and then she's washed the gravel further down there, so the eggs are in there. It looks like there's another one in there. So that's at least two reds.
So the reds, I mean, it's an interesting name, isn't it? Red. And actually, when you look at the stones, the way they've been cleared and cleaned, it does actually look red, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is that why they're called reds?
No. Not as far as I know, Pete. I mean, basically, she's the henfish. She finds the suitable location. She finds a place to spawn.
Yeah.
She digs. She goes and flips onto her side, and she digs an indent out in the gravel. Lays her eggs into it. The male comes along. He fertilises them. She then swims forward, covers them back over, and then about sort of April, May time, the young emerge out of the gravel, and it all starts again. They sort of live in the... They live in the river for about a year, 2 years, somewhere like that. And then they migrate back downstream, back to sea, go to sea for anywhere from 1 to 4 years, and then come back and do it all again. And I just think it's amazing.
Well, it is phenomenal, isn't it? The promised salmon that I was going to go and see is buggered off. But
it's selfish, isn't it?
But we've seen the reds. Shall we walk upstream?
Yeah, let's walk upstream.
Okay.
I think what I like most about this is that I've followed the salmon run all my life.
Yep, yep.
And so I've noticed the changes in everything. It's got later and later, but what's also happened is that there's fewer and fewer salmon as well.
Yep.
And this is why I'm so chuffed, because this year there seems to be lots.
Right.
And it's really bucked the trend. And yet everywhere else there seems to be just huge declines in salmon numbers. But what... I'm not taking the credit for it, but I'd like to think that I've done my bit, because I've worked on this beck.
Yeah.
And now there's salmon in it, and now they're spawning, and you think, oh, maybe it works.
Well, maybe it works, and actually, I mean, I wonder also sometimes, I know you as a lad, basically you spent all your time up to your elbows in becks, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, Mum told me that sort of her first recollection was... me disappearing when I was about 18 months, wandering off, and she found me down the beck, which was sort of quite alarming. So I had a good stint at it. I've had a good crack
So my point there is that you are someone who looks. You observe, you go into places, don't you?
You ratch. Yeah.
Do you know, that's one of my favourite work. And I used to do a lot of that in Borrowdale. When I first came up here, which is now more than 30 years ago, I used to spend my time ratching. And up the gills, under the crags, in the bits of woodland. You can't beat a good ratch, can you?
You can't. It's how you learn. We used to walk up and down this beck, all of the becks around here. I know them inside out. I think it's helped me with my job now, but yeah, we used to go fishing. We've walked them all. I've seen them go from really, really prolific becks with 20-inch brown trout in them to pretty rubbish times when there's been pollution that's wiped the whole beck out, to then coming back again now to this. So I just, yeah, it's been really, really fascinating just to watch it, and now I get paid to play in the becks as well.
Well, so I mean, that brings us nicely on to you. Who are you? What are you doing? So I mean, I'm slightly jealous of how many awards you've now won. I'm kind of waiting for
mine. It was never the intention.
But you're a kind of beck restorer, aren't you?
Yeah. I think that's fair enough. I just want to try and improve as many becks as possible. Have we got it? Yeah. Is it working?
It is working,
yeah. Yeah, I want to try and just improve as many becks as possible. It's, for me, and the CIC that I run with my wife, with Maddie, it's very much all about working with farms and farmers and seeing what we can do. It's finding the balance. Yeah. It's finding a balance between farming and then doing the right things in the right place. That's what we've always tried to do.
So you formed a community interest company, a CIC.
Yes, yep.
And that, you created that really very much after Storm Desmond, didn't you? So Desmond came through, and you learnt a lot from that experience by working in one village. And you've taken that experience and then created a business.
Well, like you say, so I've always done it. I've always messed on in becks. I've always been doing things in our beck, and loved it, absolutely loved it. It's just taking it to a sort of a bigger level, really. But like you say, we live in Glenridden. Storm Desmond came through, smashed the whole place to pieces, dropped about 18,000 ton of stone, and we wanted to look at doing things differently, and I wanted to see if we could work with farmers and look at maybe building a bit more resilience in the catchment by working upstream with them, but still working as a farm.
And you say, I mean, working with them, trying to achieve, but is your consideration primarily an environmental one, or do you feel as though it's kind of an environment twinned with a social side, really? Yeah, kind of trying to keep people in the landscape, working in the landscape, but with perhaps an environmental outcome.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's nature-friendly farming, you could call it, couldn't you? Like, Maddie and my family have historically been farmers, and goes back generations, hundreds of years. It's really, really important to us that we preserve smaller family farms, and there's such a lot that we can do on them. So we want them all to be productive and viable and sustainable. And if you do something that you can work with everybody, then everyone can do something, and then we improve the whole catchment.
Yeah. But your specific element of that is nerdling with water, shall we say.
I don't mind admitting that I am a self-professed beck nerd. I call myself that, I don't mind. Anyone knows me knows that. It's like, yeah.
You are a bit of an artist. I mean, you've given me the reins of a digger on a couple of occasions, which has been quite fun.
Yeah.
And I'm no digger driver. But what's interesting about your work is, and I'm putting words in your mouth here, but is doing almost the minimum necessary to put a beck back into a space where it can do its own thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's the technical side of it, looking at the topography and the LiDAR and things like that, and maybe where it should be. But there's also a reading the land. You've got to,
yeah.
You've got to read the land and know what it's saying and what it wants to do and where it should be.
Yeah.
So for me, I just seem to have an eye for doing that. And I have seen not very good restorations where they just don't look natural.
Yeah.
And I always think when I'm doing a beck and I'm doing something, I'm like, how would that have occurred?
Yeah.
Could that have naturally done like... If you can think that it could have happened naturally, there's a good chance that it'll fit in and it'll look right.
And it'll work.
And it'll work.
So I suppose first question is, why do you need to exist as a beck nerd? What are we mucked around with our becks?
Yeah, that's a short answer. I think, I can't remember the exact stats, I think it's about 92-94% of the becks have been modified in the Lake District.
Right.
So, a lot.
So the park did a State of Nature report recently, and in there it said 4% of our triple SI, our best rivers, are in good condition. 4%. That's in a national park, our premier national park.
I know. There are a lot of... It's not just one thing. You couldn't just point your finger at one thing and just say,
no,
it's that. It's that. It's not that easy. There's a whole plethora of issues with becks and things. But ultimately, we moved them. We've done bizarre things to becks. We put a lot of
SH1T.
Yes.
Down them.
Yeah, yeah. We there's things like that. There's a lot of stuff that just goes into them that shouldn't, that isn't really good for the wildlife. A lot of it we can do. We can sort that.
Mm.
And we should be sorting it. But a lot of the things with the river restoration work is that if you get it right, you can have natural flood management benefits.
Yeah.
It's good ecologically. Mm. It works for the farms because you're putting the draining, you're improving the natural drainage of the land.
Yeah.
And that's what I like to do. I like to, you know.
Because it is interesting. You look at a lot of the drainage that's been done and it's moved a beck right from the middle of a field to the edge of the field, or it's straightened a beck or whatever. It doesn't actually drain the field very well, does it? Not always.
The only way that they really work is to maintain them.
Yeah.
And by maintaining them, I mean digging them out.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, I think we've learned really that if we drain everywhere and dig everywhere out really, really deep, all that we do, yes, you move the water off that land very efficiently, but by the time everyone moves all the water very efficiently, Carlisle gets flooded.
Carlisle, Lancaster, Keswick, Penrith, bits of...
Exactly.
You name it. Exactly. And they're always at the lower point of the catchment. So you might have a dry field at the top of the catchment, but...
Yeah. And I just... This is where I think the DEFRA can get it right with financial incentives. Should be paying people to do this. It's like I've taken flood banks down and allowed sort of fields on there to store extra 15,000 cubic metres. That's one field.
Yeah.
But the thing is, when the flood goes down, that field drains better than it did before.
Yeah.
And you just think, well, we've taken 15,000 cube out of one area
one flood.
That was going to be rushing downstream. Yeah. Add to it. You keep building to these things, but ultimately the farmer should be getting a revenue for that because it's such a cost-efficient thing that you're doing compared to hard engineering.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those debates, though, isn't it, about whether somebody should get a revenue for something which is naturally occurring, whether there's disincentives or incentives. Should they be getting an incentive for draining a field and moving it back, which historically has been the case, or should there be an incentive for restoring it to its natural course? But what happens long term? Do we pay everybody, everywhere, to have water on the fields?
Well, I think so. I would.
Yeah?
That's what I think. Okay. I think it's a public good.
Okay.
I think when you put it into... There's a payment at the moment, making space for water. It allows you to, if you're going to move a river back to its natural course and allow it unconstrained movement, I think it pays about £700 a hectare for 20 years.
Yeah.
It's a good paying option.
Yeah.
And in the right place, it's really good. Compared to some of the flood schemes that are talking hundreds of millions of pounds, it's an absolute drop in the ocean. But if we focus on that side of things, on the natural side of things, and restoring water up there, the cost pales into in significance, and we cannot keep building flood walls in Carlisle and Keswick higher and higher and higher.
But is there, I mean, I perceive one of the issues there is the fact that you can measure what a flood wall will contain. Mm. You can do a volumetric test, you can see X volume at X number of seconds, whatever it's Qmax or whatever they're measured in, you know exactly what it's going to store and how much it's going to treat. But in a field that might get wet, and actually if it rains somewhere else might not get wet, that's more difficult
to
measure, isn't it?
It's harder to quantify for government accountability, isn't it?
Yeah.
But ultimately, if I'm slowing water off a bit of land and that was going twice as fast as it previously was, it has to have a tangible benefit downstream.
Yeah.
It's just we know it works. We know that works. So it's like, I think government are moving slowly, realising that natural flood management has benefits.
Has benefits, yeah. But also, the artistry of what you're doing is to put boulders back in the middle of the beck where they've been moved to the side. You're putting more curves back in. You're allowing a little bit of erosion to get some of those. The things we just looked at just now, those little pea-sized gravels that are essential for the salmon spawning.
Well, that is the thing, Pete. I mean, we've straightened rivers, we've dug them out, they've been really canalised.
I
don't blame me for that as well. I can't, there's so much I can be blamed for. But what happens is that when you've got those canalised becks, is that they wash all of that gravel downstream.
Yeah.
So, okay, it's not any good for the salmon and the trout because there isn't any suitable spawning size gravels, but you're also washing all of the gravels downstream, which ends up getting the bigger rivers, dropping out and building up the bigger rivers, and then that causes them to flood as well. So we need to retain, as slowing the flow of water down, we're also slowing that transport of all of those, that fine stone that the salmon need, and we're slowing that and we're storing that, and then they can use it.
And there's still sediment traps around Cumbria where Environment Agency goes and digs them out on a regular basis. Vast cost.
I know. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are places where you have to manage gravel. I'd like to think that I've got a fairly good idea about becks and rivers and things like that, and sometimes where you've got infrastructure and unnatural rivers, becks don't act naturally. So sometimes you have to clean the gravel out of there. I'm not advocating that you clean the entire system out and remove every bit of gravel from the whole system, but sometimes around bridges and infrastructure you have to. Because, you know, it's an unnatural feature in the river.
But by re-naturalising your upland becks, which is effectively what we're looking at, and we're just going to go down through Hole Gill to have a look at another section of this beck. These are tiny becks, aren't they?
Yeah.
But by putting back natural function to them, you're slowing the flow up here, providing gravels for salmon spawning. It's got multiple benefits, hasn't it?
It has got multiple benefits. Some places are more suitable than others. Yeah. This is really, really suitable. That, to me, it's finding it's the right thing, right place. This is really, really suitable. But I just learnt recently that So the EA have likely been counting salmon that leave the rivers and go to sea.
Yeah.
And it used to be that 15% of those salmon that left and went to sea, used to be 15% came back as adults.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very sort of self-perpetuating number.
Yeah.
It's now down to 2%.
Right.
So it makes the spawning salmon in these becks absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
So it may be that we only have a few numbers, but if you can get if a female has, what is it, about 400 eggs per pound of fish or something like that, the whole, you know, we're talking hundreds of eggs anyways, basically. If we can get several reds and several successfully spawning, maybe we can turn things around a little bit and start getting that percentage back up again.
And actually, you know, becks like this, people would be amazed at the size of fish coming up these becks. Because these becks, this is the kind of thing you might, as a kid, might get in your wellies and start chucking stones around because they're so tiny, aren't they?
Yeah.
But actually, they'll carry big fish.
Well, so I've seen some salmon the other day. Probably the biggest one that I saw was male fish, about 8 pound.
Right.
That's a nice sized fish. But like going back to when I were a lad, there was a 30 pound salmon dead just downstream at Dacre. I don't think we'll ever see them days again, but I'd love to think that it was possible.
Yeah.
But that is a phenomenal fish.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so we're talking about fish that in these becks, you'd see the back of the fish above the water level, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
In some areas when they're coming over the stones.
Well, let's
we've got to climb a fence and go down through some stones. So I'm going to just turn us off for a minute and then we'll reconvene in a minute.
Sounds good.
So we've just come down through Holger Wood, which I love. This is probably, in the locality where we are, probably one of the best ancient woodlands that we've got, Danny. And it's an absolute picture of bluebell and other dog's mercury and all those kind of things in the spring. It's absolutely brilliant. And actually, we're only just a few metres down from the A66, which actually is one of the reasons we came here today.
Sorry, Pete, there's one in there.
Right.
There's a salmon there, just there.
Oh, yeah. That's fantastic.
There. Oh, that's nice. There's another one there.
That's cool. I'm chuffed a bit. That's wonderful. That is wonderful.
That is a big fish as well.
That's a big fish. Wow, there's two. Is there there's a bigger fish and a smaller fish, isn't there? Just huddled up together.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, Danny's just dropped his x-ray specs on his face just to see a little bit clearer.
Just polarise, try them on. It should just take a bit of glare off. That's
now I'm
nice.
Looking like an old style blues musician from the 60s. Oh, that is. And do you know what?
It doesn't make very good listening, does it?
It doesn't make good listening, but do you know what? It's just, as you said, it's just. I mean, you know, these becks, you said, have been underperforming for years, and now to see live salmon in here spawning.
It gives you hope. It gives you hope that maybe we can turn things around. Maybe they're not going to go extinct. I came up with my daughter the other night, and we came to watch them.
Yeah.
And she's a typical teenager, social media, all of the other things.
Yeah.
And she was amazed
just
by
wrapped.
Them.
Yeah.
And I just think, and I said to her, I said, I'm so pleased that you've seen this, because I said, I honestly think in your lifetime, these will go extinct. We'll lose these. But to see them now, you're just like, it just makes me want to do more, basically, and try harder to preserve them.
I'm the same with conservation stuff. I mean, we were on a site earlier this week with a colleague, and we're up there. It's on a common, it's a scrub scheme. We took a lot of personal battering. You know, the naysayers were there, so you should know the pastures there. Do you know what? It was hooching with grouse. Hooching with them.
Yeah.
And there's not a keeper in sight. You know, and it's like, well, bring back the scrub, bring back the habitat, release it from that overgrazing that's been happening. And there is hope.
Yeah, yeah.
We just have to change our psyche about land management.
This is it. I think we can all do a bit, can't we? We can all. And I mean, this bit of land where we're at, this woodland, This is perfect for it. There is no agricultural benefit to this bit of land.
No.
So therefore, these are the bits we should really focus on. And I am just blown away by that. That's salmon. Cool. That is.
Well, its tail keeps flicking at us every so often. It's sat there. It knows we're here.
Yeah.
But it's not shoved off upstream, is it? I'm sure there's two sat next to each other.
Yeah.
Well, that's made my. I don't know if it's made my year, but it certainly made my day. That's the red in there,
that's
isn't
the
it?
Red.
Yeah.
So there's one there,
and there's one there.
Next to it as well.
So there's two. So we've seen four reds at least.
Yeah.
On this wee beck.
So you can see now that that's quite a lot of thousands of salmon eggs now.
Yeah, yeah.
Back into this.
So, but we're also, because we're just down from the A66, we're also aware very much, in fact, they're moving around quite a lot. There's more than three, there's more than two salmon there.
There are.
There's more than two there. Yes.
So I think what's going on there, I think there'll be one female, there'll be one male that's trying to mate with her, and then there's a third party that's... Yeah.
Disgruntled.
Disgruntled, yes, and being chased out the way. They don't like to share. So I think that's what's happening there. So he is hanging around, he's protecting that red,
yep.
And he wants his progeny to be the one that's successful. And there's no room for three in that
bed. There's no
bed.
Room for three. But I've come back to the 60s. This is also taking some salts. It's taking hydrocarbons, it's taking oils and things off the road, it's taking bits of tyre, isn't it? So this is not a pristine stream, is it? And there's a wee bit of scum on the top. Having said this, it goes up quite a fair way beyond the 66, doesn't it?
So yeah. It's probably got about another 3 miles or more to go upstream, and then there's various separate little tributaries that it goes to. But we need to do better. The old style drainage was everything goes in the beck.
Yeah.
Everything from the 66, from the A66 gets drained into the beck, and there is a lot of horrible crud that comes into
it. So really we could do with some settlement ponds.
At the very least, we need some settlement ponds in it. And I think it's when we see this that it kind of highlights that, we need to get on with it. We need to look after this. If we get too much sediment, too much crud comes into this beck, what happens is, although the salmon have laid their eggs in the finer gravels, that fine silt, that fine sediment, chokes them and it smothers the oxygen and it kills the eggs. Right. So that's the end of that cycle then.
And also, in terms of climate change, we've got temperature issues happening with salmon.
Yeah.
I mean, here's nice shade, lots of leaf litter. This is actually quite a nice cool section of beck. It's probably quite cool. But temperature's an issue. But we've also got the flooding issue. And those reds are set right slap bang in the middle of the river, aren't they?
Mm. They know. It's amazing how they know. They naturally know where is the best place. It's just right. The flow has slowed down enough so that in a big flood it doesn't get washed out and all the eggs washed away, but it's got just the right place for the oxygen just to run through the gravel and keep the eggs oxygenated and keep them healthy. Amazing.
But with the increasing kind of dumps of water, we're getting some of those floods at the worst time of year. And they can be more destructive, can't they?
Yeah, it's changing. So I've seen the whole pattern of the salmon run changing. So over the last 30 years, it used to be last week of October, that's when you would see the salmon now.
Yeah.
Now, we're nearly end of November now,
aren't we? We're a month later, aren't we?
And so I can only think that is climate change. The water temperature is changing, the season's changing, and it's moving, it's disrupting things. But then we get into, as we do now, we're getting droughts as well. So a lot of these little streams, not this one, thankfully, but a lot of the smaller streams do drought off.
And again, a good reason, this combination of what I do, tree planting, what you do, but is actually we know that by restoring tree cover to the upper areas and the upper reaches of these streams, we can actually maintain flows, even in droughted conditions. And by restoring some natural flows, you're slowing down the flow of water. You're not shugging that water off quite as quickly, are you? So,
no, and I mean, and the tree planting goes with the soil health as well. We get some good, healthy soils that are holding that water in. They're slowing it down. It infiltrates into it. Better for the drought as well. It's just, we need to value these things a lot more, really.
But Danny, you and I both have suffered for our art, haven't we? I mean, I know we're not universally loved, are we?
Well, I have got a thankfully very small sort of group that dislike trees and don't like what's going on. It is a very small group ultimately, but they're quite vocal in that they don't think that it's the right thing. I think the thing is, those people have never actually asked me what I'm doing.
Yeah.
If they'd spoken to me, they would find that I was 100% supportive of farming.
Yeah.
I am, and I always am. I'm very, very open about that. That I 100% support farming. It's just that I want to work with farms, and I do work with farms, and I think the majority can see that I'm not a threat.
Yeah.
This isn't threatening what I'm doing. It's just working with them to make changes like this so that we can see things that we've seen today.
And actually, you know, I feel very, very much the same. But I think there's a lot of threat in farming at the moment with changing, demographics. There's an old farmers, but also just the changing grant systems and the economics of it. It's not necessarily an easy place. And actually, some of the threats that have come through, perhaps some of the rewilding type things, or I think more scary really is probably some of the corporates buying land to offset carbon, which appears to be anti-farming. I can see there's lots of threats there, and maybe we're perceived in that light, that we're a threat to farming, but I don't think we should be.
I think we're sort of... People are very, very... Farmers are very worried about what's going on. Mm. It is very worrying times, and sometimes they just need a human to vent at. You can't vent at these big organisations, so it just happens that if we're there, we bear the brunt.
We get the flak, don't we?
And it's not very nice. Yeah. Anyone that's said that to me or have given me that, they've never actually asked me what it is that I'm doing. Yeah. And if they did, then I'm sure that they'd be pretty supportive of it in the end, like the majority of the rest of the farmers that I work with.
Well, it was interesting. We had a community hedge laying event in Keswick a couple of weekends ago, and... third hand, I got the abuse because I'm pretty smiley, and I chat to everybody that passes.
You know, yeah.
I think you should engage people when you can.
Yeah.
This is it's a thing. We're doing something here, and we've got volunteers. And, why do those people take it upon themselves to slag me off? Not to my face.
No.
But externally, and it get back to me. It's in a sense more hurtful, but it's also pretty stupid because I'd have chatted with them and said what we were doing, which is pretty good. It's a good thing. It's a very traditional thing.
Yeah, but it's not on. It's not acceptable that folk think it's all right to do that. At the end of the day, we're only human.
Well, I'm not some corporate that you can't even get a telephone number for.
No.
You have to contact me with a website. You know, I'm pretty obvious, aren't I?
Yeah. It's tough. It is. It's tough at times. I mean, for me, I have taken it to heart at times because I've ultimately, I genuinely believe what I'm doing is the right thing for the majority of people. And so sometimes when you've put your heart and soul into something and then someone tells you that it's a load of rubbish and you're doing the totally wrong thing, then it hurts and it sticks.
Well, that's the problem. It does stick, isn't it? And it's like that. You know, you can have 100 good things, but the one bad thing is the one you remember, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So when I'm playing a gig, and that one bum note, I can for weeks, you know. But that's the point. It does stick, and I think that's where both of us have had our issues mentally with feeling under a lot of pressure, and we're trying to do the right thing, but actually it does take its toll, doesn't it?
It does. It does. I mean, it's. Like I've had issues with my mental health for the last 25 years, on and off. I've never understood it. I didn't understand it from a rural background. It's something that you didn't talk about.
No.
Nobody talked about it. No. It wasn't understood. You know, it was eventually got to the point where you go to the doctors and you get some pills and you get on with it, don't you?
Yeah.
And that's not a good way of dealing with anything.
No, not at all.
I'm pleased that people are talking more about it now, and it is acceptable, and it should be acceptable, because when I've spoken to lots of people, and then you find out that they've had anxiety, they've had depression as well, and it starts the conversation. We've got to stop being so. We've got to stop hiding it away. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
There's no shame in it.
But also, I wonder if I think the digitisation of society hasn't helped, because there's much more isolation from that. But I also wonder whether you and I are both physical people. I like being outside working.
Mm.
I feel my top when I've been working physically outside and with people. And I wonder if actually that we've lost quite a lot of that.
It could be, like you. Quite a lot of my job's on the computer.
Yeah.
And then quite a lot of my job is sat in a digger, which, don't get me wrong, I love it. I absolutely love it to bits. I love playing on big toys.
Man, aren't you?
I am. I mean, I'm in my element. But you are on your own. Yeah. And I think we need that. We need the interaction. Yeah. We need to talk.
We're social species, aren't we, at the end of the day? We need to talk. So.
And actually, you know, I know when we've got together on jobs, and I don't know how many projects we've now done together, but quite a few.
I've lost count now. We're at that.
I was leave smiling because we've had a really good interaction, and it's great, isn't it? Yeah.
It's nice. I think, as you say, it's that social media, isn't it? It's that internet. Everything's, you know, you lose in human interaction, don't you?
And polarising as well. And I think that's one of the fears, you know, in the upcoming elections in America and things like that. You just look at the polarisation in society, and it shouldn't and needn't be that way.
The polarisation was something that... So when I started the CIC, that was the big thing for me. That polarisation, it was either... You either farm or you rewild.
Yeah.
Blunt as that. Yeah. Yeah. And I said, but there doesn't need to be that. So I sit firmly in the middle... And now I get shouted at from both sides now.
Well, that's what I like about regen farming. And I'm absolutely, because it's bringing back natural processes to a farming scenario. So we're farming better with wildlife.
Yeah.
And the wildlife's coming back. And actually, both of us have worked on a farm not very far from here, where the principle now is regenerative. And, you know, I've been working with the wood pasture that we're creating there, and you've been working with the Becks.
Mm.
And that's joyful, isn't it, when that all starts to come together?
Yeah. I just think it's such a good example.
Yeah.
It's such a good example. Yeah. They're producing fantastic, sustainable, grass-fed beef.
Yeah.
And in a really, really wildlife-friendly way.
They're still producing food, but they're not importing
Amazonian
soy.
No.
They're not using lots of machinery. So using diesel and putting carbon up in the atmosphere, producing food. It's a different way of looking at it, but
it works for the farm though. Farms need to focus on the inputs.
Yeah.
Whether that's fertilisers, artificial fertilisers, whether it's feed costs, these are all massive input costs that farming can't make up.
No.
It kind of leads me, you know, it frustrates me really that as consumers, I don't think we value high welfare, nature-friendly farmed livestock enough. It should be a premium. It should be openly there, and it should be a premium. And I think that part of that is probably education, that we need to explain why that bit of beef costs £5 and that bit of beef costs £8. Well, it's because that one's taken an extra year to grow and it hasn't had any inputs into it.
But is there a market? I mean, this is the other thing, is markets. So if everything's supermarket-based, where do you go to get your 100% pasture-fed reared beef? Oh. And around here?
Yeah, we've got farm shops. We have got... Yep. Well, I should probably... Basecamp.
Yep.
Cracking farm shop.
Yeah.
Really good. And again, I'm going to be working there next summer, so there's wetlands and Becks to do and make. But again, and it'll have wood pasture, but... you know, that land can still be farmed. Mm. It can still be used. Not stopping anything.
And coming back to the Becks, of course, those those inputs, a lot of them run off into the Becks, don't they?
Yeah, and that is that sort of them added nutrients aren't great for the water. Oh, there's a little trout in there as well. I just missed that. So what is quite interesting is, sorry, we've changed subject, but the trout, the resident trout. That are in the Beck already, they'll follow the salmon, and when she's laying her eggs, they'll nip in and eat a few. So the male will actually, he'll actually sort of try and chase them away as well. So he's busy. He's got a lot to do. So he's chasing the others away. He's chasing the trout away.
So he's got a lot on his plate.
He's got a lot on his plate.
Nutrients.
So, nutrients. I mean, yes.
What's the effect of those nutrients in the Beck?
Lots. I mean, depending on the sorts of nutrients, but as I touched on before, you get lots of... if you get to the point where you've got an excess of nutrient sediments, soils that are washing off, they choke the gravels up, they choke the eggs off. depending on what's in those inputs, then it can kill the invertebrates. It can kill the, you know, all the things that the fish eat in the beck. There's another red there.
Okay. Yeah.
So yeah, we need to try and keep. And ultimately, it doesn't make financial sense for any farm business to be losing those nutrients.
No.
You know, you need to keep them on the land, keep them in the soil. That's where they need to be. Not in here, so.
And actually, in terms of the, again, the tree and beck thing, which I like, is the fact that we need those trees in the upper areas to shade the watercourse.
Yeah.
But also that leaf litter helps to feed the invertebrates, ultimately.
Well, and the timber itself, the actual wood itself. So when we'll go up to this bit here, you can see there are old trees that fall in the watercourse. And what it does is it helps kickstart the beck. It moves the beck around.
Right.
Or when there's big flows hit that timber, it helps scour out deeper holes. Well, that's your habitat for your fish. That's where your bigger fish are living.
Oh, there's a dipper as well.
Yep.
It's one of my favourite little birds. Up two, in fact. There we go. It's a pair. Bit of a squeak to each other.
I always think, when you look at... We've become kind of programmed to look at... To look at becks and look at rivers and think that there should be one channel.
Yep. Yeah.
And that's what we think. But really, and naturally, this is what it should be. When you're allowed and when space allows, there's trees that have fallen into the river and then they've washed deeper bits out, they drop gravels in other places, they then jump around, they move around, and they've got multiple different channels.
So here we're looking upstream at two distinct channels. There's lots of deadwood, so there's trees lying on their side in the beck. There's quite a lot of ivy on one of them. There's bits of deadwood. There's big rocks in the middle of the stream, but there's also little shoals which have got smaller gravels. And that water is really working hard to get round stuff. It's not flowing in a kind of uniform flow.
And you think that when this beck's in flood and it's really hammering it downstream, the wood's helping to slow it all back a little bit at a time and helps push it out onto the floodplain. And again, it's just, you know, it's these multiple little easy interventions like that. I always think that if the trees are secure, if they're stable,
yep,
and they're not at risk of washing out, washing downstream, blocking the bridge, leave them. And these trees are still tethered by the roots. Yep. Some of them are still alive, so they're not going anywhere.
But we have, I mean, again, looking at the river just downstream from Keswick, we have had some big trees falling into the river. Now, in a perfectly natural system, great, because it kicks off an erosion, doesn't it? Yeah. But actually, below Keswick, we've got multiple bridges, and actually, that's a bit of an issue.
But it is, though, isn't it? It, like I say, it's not suitable everywhere.
Yeah.
Stuck record, aren't I? It's like the right thing in the right place. Yeah. You can't risk that. But here, we're in a woodland. If a tree washes loose, it'll just wash up on the side, on the floodplain.
Yeah.
There's no risk here. So the benefit that they're doing to the beck far, far outweighs any potential risk in here.
And given that we think 92-ish% of our upland becks have been mucked around with, there's plenty of work for you and me to get on with.
Yeah.
We're not gonna run out of business, are we?
Well, I hope not. I really hope not. And I do have lots of farmers get in touch and inquire. What I do isn't re-wetting entire fields and taking that land out of use. It's just being able to incorporate some bends.
Yeah.
Or making some habitat a bit better. Mm. Or putting the big material, the big stones, the big boulders back in that we've dredged out once upon a time, that we've done that. And all of those little interventions, that's where your fish are hiding.
Yeah.
There's the habitat. That's what we've taken out and that's what we've lost. We can put them back in quite easily.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that fish habitat's really, it is crucial, isn't it? Because we've got lots of predation on fish.
Yeah.
And in terms of population sizes, if you've got 100 of something and you lose 10%, that's only 10 fish. If you only got 10 fish
and you lose 10%, you start to really erode the population, don't you?
This is my worry with salmon. I think, I genuinely think that we're pretty near that pivot point,
yeah,
where it'll tip,
yeah,
and they won't be able to recover,
yeah,
from the numbers. That's my, that is my real worry.
Well, I remember speaking to you early in the year, and you said I've gone up to Scotland to look at salmon because they might not be here in my lifetime.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a massive, that is a genuine concern.
Yeah,
that is a genuine concern, and I think it reflects really, really badly on us as a species.
Hmm.
If we're going to go and let them go extinct on our watch.
I'm not going to use the butt word here. Well, I am. But we could say that about so many species. Curlew,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah.
There's lots of stuff on our watch.
Yeah.
That all we've done is map decline. I'm on record in meetings as saying, you know, we say, we need a mapping project. No, we don't. We actually need to do something.
Yeah.
Stop mapping decline. We keep doing it.
Yeah.
And we know it's happening.
Exactly. And we're not stopping that decline.
No.
Some of the things, unfortunately, some of the solutions are unpalatable. It's as simple as that.
Well, politically or socially?
Well, both, really. But ultimately, we don't have a functioning predation system. We don't have apex,
right,
predators. I am not suggesting for a minute that we put wolves back into the landscape. I am not doing that. But what's happening, and with relation to the curlews and things like that, we have an explosion of the next of that mid-level predation. So your badgers and your foxes, and you know, there isn't any natural control of that. In my opinion, I think there should be. I'm not on about exterminating. You know me. I'm not on about exterminating anything. I just think that we must have balance back to things, because otherwise, unfortunately, the pressures on the bottom of the food chain are too great that we will lose things. As I said to you, I've watched the salmon run on this beck for the last 30 plus years.
Yeah.
And I've watched it go down,
yeah,
every year.
Every year, yeah.
And I just... I mean, this is bucking the trend.
Yep.
This absolutely...
This year, for the first time in many years.
For the first time that trend has been booked, and it absolutely... And I know I'm a droll, miserable northern bugger, but it honestly does fill me with joy to see this. I am chuffed. So we can, you know, we can do things. But I'm going to be starting a mink trapping program throughout here. Mink, the non-native, shouldn't be here.
Mm.
Absolutely decimate watercourses. I'm going to be trapping them, removing them, and I've had traps that are squashed, stamped on, because people don't like the thought,
yeah,
of it.
Yeah.
As I said, there are unpalatable actions.
Well, it's not easy,
times,
is it? But I mean, and the other thing which we should be doing is actually all of these becks should be put back into good order.
Yeah.
And actually, that habitat is absolutely critical. Without habitat, you're not going to get restoration.
No.
So.
We can do that easily. Even if we didn't do anything, but we fenced out a 3-metre strip,
yeah,
on either side to prevent runoff, the habitat that it makes is amazing.
And we've done that upstream, haven't we? There must have been nine or ten little projects in,
yeah,
one section of Beck.
Yeah.
And I think it's where we first met, actually, wasn't it? Pretty much.
So.
And that's going back 50...
Hundreds of
years. Hundreds of years. It's going back a wee way. And they felt very small at the,
yeah,
time, didn't they, those interventions? But they've made a massive difference.
And now
massive difference.
And now there's other ones. You know, that's it, though, isn't it? When we started doing... And it's like you think, that's not going to make any difference, is it? If I fence that one bit off, that's not going to make any difference. But then we worked with my neighbours, and then,
yeah,
they do the same.
Yeah.
And then the other neighbour does the same.
Yeah.
And then we start expanding and expanding and expanding. And,
yeah,
now I've just taken that to a catchment level now.
Yeah.
And all of these individual projects are all beginning to link up now. And it's...
And they are. And how do you change a landscape? Well, I think lots of people say, well, you change it at scale. And I think you can in some cases. But a landscape like this is all about people and incremental change. And I think that's exactly what we've been doing.
I think so.
Incremental change.
I think it's removing the fear of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
What we've done
isn't scary, and people can see it. And I think initially, people were scared because they thought, what the hell are you doing? Mm. I don't like this, this is different.
Yeah.
Humans don't like different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cumbrians definitely don't like different. I am Cumbrian, I think I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah.
But it's not scary. It's just that it's just a little bit different, that's all.
Yeah.
But it makes a big difference in the bigger scheme.
Yeah.
And it's that, it is the people thing, it is the farming thing, it's all of it, it's protecting all of it. I've lived here forever, and like I want to look after the place.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to think that when I kick the bucket, I've left it, I've made my contribution and done more than I've taken, basically. That's what I want to see.
Well, all I can say is, Danny, it has been a pleasure working with you all these years. I want to continue working with you. Let's hope we do.
I hope so.
And thanks for contributing to the Treamble podcast.
Very welcome.
I've been really looking forward to this interview. And I've just because I thought, well, if I do come out with Danny, at least I'll see some salmon. And I have done. So thanks so much, Danny. And power to your organ.
Thank you, thank you.
Danny has won awards for his work, and it's great. It's a joy to work alongside someone with such passion and energy and knowledge as Danny. Next time, we are in South Cumbria with a company called Lake District Farmers. You've been listening to the Treamble podcast, written and produced by myself, Pete Leeson. My special thanks go to Pete Ord for his awesome production and mixing skills. And actually, Pete and Pete, both of us, we wrote the music, so thanks very much to Pete for his input there. The recording was on location with mixing and production at the studio at Sunbeams, part of the Annie Mawson Sunbeams Music Trust. Thanks also to all those lovely people who were interviewed, Simon Wakefield for the artwork, and my special thanks go to those who gave me the confidence and support to make this happen. Angela, Anne, Catherine, Tim, Kevin, Emma, Nick and Paul. Thank you.